If you haven't played Paddy Power Fantasy yet, you're missing out. But on the upside, if you haven't played it yet, you qualify for a risk-free first go. Get up to £20 back as cash when you play Paddy Power Fantasy. And because every NFL game day is a season in itself, you don't have to wait to find out if you've won. Paddy Power Fantasy. Hate waiting, love winning. New customer offer, min £5, max £20 refund. T's and C's apply. Paddy Power Fantasy rules apply. 18 plus, begambleaware.org.
Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show presented by Paddy Power Fantasy. Well, 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 just one or two things to be getting into after an explosive week 14 in the NFL. The over-under in the 49ers Saints game was 45 points, which means that both New Orleans and San Francisco beat the over individually. That tells you all you need to know. One of the great defenses of modern times having 46 points put up against it. And yet the Saints still don't win the game. What a match. Game of the season. One of the games of recent times in the NFL. And Nicky Bandini, no less, will be joining us to break it all down. We'll talk about the Patriots' defeat at Foxborough to the Chiefs as well. And understandably, Bill Belichick and co. not particularly happy with how that one went down. Two touchdowns, they feel, taken away from their grasp, which would, of course, change the dynamic of that game. The Ravens, the number one seed in the AFC now, a win, a tough win against the Buffalo Bills. The Titans rolling, trying to catch the Texans and sneak in to the playoffs. They're very much the form team right now. We'll look at the NFC as well with the Rams win on Sunday Night Football, making the wildcard race interesting. Again, there's so much to get into, so we'll get straight on with it. And Nicky Bandini. Nicky Bandini, how are you?
I'm doing good now. How are you?
You know, they say timing is everything. In your case, that is absolutely on the button, because every time we've worked together this season, it's whether it's been a live game in the studio or a pod after reflecting on a brilliant Sunday of NFL football, you have picked some absolute blinders. And talk about the best weekend of football to talk about to come on the Monday show. So congratulations, first things first, for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel very lucky with the ones I've got to chat about with you this season. This was, obviously we're talking about the Niners and Saints here, and 48-46 to the Niners. And of course, sort of mine goes back to last season and the 54-51 game between the Rams and Chiefs. I don't know about you, Nat. I thought this game was even better.
I do as well, because it was all the things that coming into the game people were pointing on. For example, this brilliant 49ers D, which the Ringer pointed out, isn't just one of the top defenses in the NFL right now. In terms of a DVOA, which of course is a kind of really key stat, one of the top 10 defenses of all time. So adjusted defense, looking at the more sublime metrics defensively, one of the top defenses of all time, this Niners defense, giving up this amount to the New Orleans Saints. And yet the Saints protecting Drew Brees, not a single sack on him, unable to win the game. Brees walking, I mean, you know, the cliche that, oh, no one deserved to lose that game. This might be the absolute prototype of a game that neither side deserved to lose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, to touch on what you just said, I think the Niners had the best sack percentage in the whole league coming into this weekend, as you said, actually historic in some of their production. Didn't get to Brees at all. And some of that was Brees getting the ball out quickly, and we know he can do that. I mean, that's obviously, I think we talked about this on the podcast earlier this season, me and you, the fact that maybe his arm strength isn't quite where it was, but his ability to dissect defense, to make quick decisions is, of course, right up there with maybe, you know, only Tom Brady. And that's because they've been around long enough to see things that others can't see. But actually, I thought on some of those plays, it wasn't even just that. He was getting protection. He was able to sit in the pocket. He was able to hang back there sometimes. I just thought it was extraordinary pass protection, on one side, and Drew Brees, showing all of his sort of, moxie and experience. And then on the other side, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you could not be in love with Kyle Shanahan's play calling this season. It's just so much fun. Big time Shanistan over here. Kyle Juszczyk pitching the ball to Mostert and getting absolutely planted for it.
Absolutely caked. In what was he doing in the game in the studio? It flashed up and I thought, oh my God, and oh, these being, Is he being helped up? What's going on? Right in the next play. Literally, he's got to bounce straight back up. Yeah. I'm good to go. Not coming up.
Tough guy, Carl.
Did he get hit twice as well? Did he get something happened later on as well? I'm sure he got pancaked again.
I think you're right.
I think that was finally put him out of the game for a little while anyway.
A few tough guys in this game as well, because of course later on we had George Kittle on that giant third and short, which all I could think of when I was watching that, weirdly, do you remember the movie? You will remember it. I don't know whether you remember the scene well enough. The movie Varsity Blues.
Of course, Varsity Blues, yep.
And without spoiling it too badly for anyone, where they throw the pass to Billy Bob. And you see in that scene, of course, they've hammed it up to the maximum because it's a high school football movie. and by the end of it, he has about half the team on top of him as he sort of falls forward dramatically. Yeah. And that was that's all I could think of. Because by the end, it wasn't even like people were trying to take Kittle down by conventional means. It was just like sheer weight of bodies was eventually going to force him to fall over.
It was it was straight out of WWE. It looked like it was being completely staged, but was actually happening in front of us. Marcus Williams, who was and the crucial thing about that play was obviously not the 30 odd yards that Kittle got, but then the face mask penalty, Marcus Williams gave up. He was the guy that gave up the Minneapolis Miracle, of course.
Yeah.
He was there. So he's a difficult couple of years for Marcus Williams. And that was critical, really. That was probably the out of an extraordinary game, the seminal play, wasn't it? The play that locked and loaded it for the 49ers.
Yeah. I mean, when you say seminal play, I think, well, how did we decide that? Yes, it was the one that finally sort of put the nail in, maybe. Because up to that point, it just felt like it could go on, forever with these teams going back and forth at each other. I don't know. I mean, it was just amazing, all of it, right down to Emmanuel Sanders, you know, throwing for touchdowns and receiving touchdowns, and what a sort of rebirth he's had there. And I love Emmanuel Sanders. I always thought he was an underestimated force in Denver because everyone's attention was on Demaryius Thomas, but I think he's a really great receiver. And, again, Shanahan finding creative ways to get even more out of him. It almost felt like, sort of on one, like I say, on one side, this sort of version of footballing purity. And there's something very pure about Drew Brees. I don't know what it is. I mean, he does, again, things I'm sure you've seen, his TV commercials, he always looks like he's almost too wholesome to be comfortable selling things. Like he's not actually very good at it. He doesn't look wholly comfortable sort of being a goof on
Shilling.
TV, like even Peyton Manning might have been. Mm. But he is just this sort of ridiculously talented pure passer, and actually, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo threw the ball really well in this game, really, really well, and in a big game, sort of shutting some people up maybe about his talent level. But it felt like it was the sort of the purity of that Saints attack against nevertheless the creativeness of that San Francisco attack, and in the end the creativeness just edged it.
Let's talk about Garoppolo. I think it's really fair to say, is this his best performance to date as a pro, do you think?
I mean, it was pretty good. What was it? 26 to 35, 349 yards, 10 yards an attempt, which is huge. Four touchdowns, and the only interception, obviously, was, you know, off his receiver's hands. So, it was pretty special. And of course, you know, the two things tied together, you have more room to work with as a quarterback if the defense is still got its head spinning and can't work out at any given moment if someone's about to pitch the ball to someone else in an unexpected way. But I thought this was a really great, Monsieur performance in a game that couldn't sort of, outside of being a playoff elimination game, couldn't matter more. You know, this was a straightforward head-to-head for very likely the number one seed in the NFC. So, first of all, a team that you're probably going to, well, not probably, because of course in the playoffs anything can happen, but you would very possibly have to beat again to get to the Super Bowl. The opportunity for home field through the playoffs with the bye and everything. It was, probably the biggest stage that he's stood on since stepping away from New England. And I don't know what more you could ask from him.
We were talking about this in the studio, actually, and Ollie, our producer, obviously also produces the pod, was taking the mickey out of me for making the comparison with Joe Montana, but the which is a reasonable, it's a reasonable criticism.
Not at all, primitive. Yeah.
No, not at all. I was getting very carried away. But the point I was making was the just how relaxed Garoppolo looked. It was right in the heat of the game, and they cut to him, and he had a big grin on his face. It reminded me of that legendary drive when Montana points out John Candy before taking the team down to win the Super Bowl.
I don't know that you can, you know, assign that label to Jimmy Garoppolo on a week when we've still got Ryan Tannehill to talk about.
Fair point.
But I do know where you're coming from. And actually, you know, it's a thing which, again, I'm certain you and I have spoken about on broadcast in the past before. One of the things that tends to come out with sort of the deep dive number crunching that goes on now around clutch performance is that there is, you know, there's really very little evidence of any players sort of consistently raising their game in clutch situations. What there is evidence of lots of people whose game tends to drop in clutch situations, and a small number who are able to maintain their normal level of performance in clutch situations. And I think that is a lot to do with how calm you can keep yourself. It's how much can you just stay in your regular zone regardless of what's going on around you. So it's definitely a trait that is significant.
No doubt about that. And he got props, no least than Richard Sherman, who went out of the game early on. Sherman calling, heaping praise on Garoppolo and the offense in totality. And typical of a player like Sherman, I think, and understandable given the offensive masterclass that we saw on both sides, disappointed with how the D performed. Interesting what Sherman said, Nikki, about it, because you referenced Shanahan on the other side of the ball, mixing and trick playing and all kinds of left field stuff coming out there. Less so from the Saints, and not entirely, of course, because Taysom Hill cropped up and Sean true. Payton, you know, isn't exactly a straight down the line coordinator. But nevertheless, Sherman said, well, firstly, thank goodness for our offense. Thank goodness for Garoppolo, Kittle, the entire offense. They made plays when they had to. I'm talking about the defense, he said it's frustrating because of simple plays. It's not like they beat us with a bunch of trick misdirection plays. These are day one football plays that we have to execute better. So just bearing that in mind and putting the brakes on a little bit. Of course, the 49ers, not least to the point you made, that it really puts them in a strong position in terms of playoff seedings and home field advantage and everything else. And they've won one of the games of modern times. But their defense was really shown up here by the Saints. So how concerned should they be that Drew Brees and the Saints offense was able to do what it did?
I think, of course, when you have been as effective as they have at, I think in particular, being able to rush the passer, and you have a game like this where you can't lay a finger on a quarterback, I think that's the thing that is almost most troubling to me. And you think, what happened? What was this offense able to do against us that, that stopped us from doing what we're normally so good at? Is it just that we were beaten individually by superior players, or is it something that happened with the schemes? Is it something that, they saw in our defense that they were able to counter? And I definitely don't think you hit any sort of panic from a game like this, because, I mean, first of all, again, you're 10-2 and you're now sort of on course for the number one seed. And secondly, no one else has been able to do this to you yet. So it's much more likely that this is an outlier, than it is the sort of the new norm. But of course you look to learn lessons from it. Yes, I suppose maybe I'd need to do a deep dive on the tape before I'd have some sort of firm opinions about exactly what those lessons are. But, of course, the coaching staff don't sort of look at this and go, we won and that's it and we're all set. This is something that if you are the next team playing the Niners, you're going to have a very good look at. You're going to say, how did Drew Brees get through that game with his shirt clean? What happened? And we'll find out, I suppose, in a week's time, whether or not there are some lessons that are so easily applicable that any old team can pick them up. Personally, I highly doubt it.
Well, they got the Falcons up next, so that is a relatively easy bounce, I think. But of course, their running includes both the Rams, who won on Sunday Night Football, beating the Seahawks, who are the 49ers' final game of the season. So it is all to play for still, certainly in terms of the NFC West, certainly in terms of the NFC seedings. Let's talk about the Seahawks-Rams game next then, Nikki, because it was a game that absolutely had people split down the middle, even Vegas, which had it virtually as a pick 'em. I think it was a 1-point line. And every expert I read, I spoke to, it was 50-50 down the line who was going to win this game. It was comfortable in the end, of course, for the LA Rams. Russell Wilson just couldn't get going at all. Concerns now moving forwards in terms of the running game with injuries for Seattle. And one of the key things that the Rams said and McVay said going into the game was that they were going to unleash Todd Gurley. We were speculating what that meant. Has Gurley been, as many people have suggested, banged up for quite a while and now he's fully fit? Is it to do with the way that McVay has worked out how to use him with a realigned offensive line and the lack of Brandon Cooks, and it's a different offense to last year? Wasn't sure what it meant. Either way, we got our answer. Gurley, great week last week. A touchdown and over 100 scrimmage yards once again this week. So he's really coming to the fore. The Rams have blown any chance of winning the NFC West, but do you think they can sneak into the playoffs as a wild card?
I think they definitely can. I think it's not straightforward because the NFC wild card picture is still pretty competitive. I do find the Gurley situation fascinating. Of course, he's not the only one. There's been a number of running backs, and I think we're increasingly getting used to this new normal almost, where we don't trust running backs to continue to produce at a high level for more than a few years. But I still think there's room for a lot more than the sort of simplistic, oh, this person is no longer at the peak of their powers and therefore they are nothing at all. And I think that we've seen so many examples recently, Todd Gurley even among them, of running backs who have been overworked early in seasons and not had much tread left on the tires late in seasons. And I think that, why do we assume that some of Gurley's sort of more scant use earlier in the season wasn't very, very deliberate and targeted at getting to this point of the season in a more productive shape? Now, of course, you can make an argument whether that was a good decision if it's meant losing some games in the meantime. He certainly looked good, as you said, the last 2 weeks. I don't think we're seeing peak Gurley. I don't think we saw his very, very best in this game, because I still feel like there's something missing, not in the reads, which he's still got, not in the cuts, not in the ability to throw someone to the floor with a stiff arm, which we saw really well on that 7-yard touchdown run. But there's just something missing in the sort of absolute top end of his speed, I think, which is stopping us from seeing quite the breakaways that we used to get. But I think that what he does in terms of picking lanes, in terms of putting a hit on a defender when he needs to, but also the shiftiness that he's able to combine with that, I think he has a lot of those tools still at his disposal. And I think that it's striking how much better the whole offense looks when he is a prominent part in it. I do think that's really striking. I think you look at, for instance, how much less pressure there was on Jared Goff, and in turn, how much more, I don't know how much more Jared Goff looks like an NFL quarterback when he's not dealing with constant pressure, was really significant.
Yeah, Goff, like Drew Brees in the previous game, not sacked at all. And unlike Wilson, who was getting hustled and hurried quite a lot of the time, a lot of people citing a return to vintage McVay or classic McVay with the jet sweeps and the mixing up in that respect as well. One stat that really stood out for me, Nikki: the Rams made 5 trips to the red zone, 4 touchdowns. So not messing around when it came to the crunch in that respect. And the Seahawks, big, big loss for them because of this battle for the NFC West division. The 49ers now wrestling back control of that. Of course, it could still come down to week 17. But the other key issue for them is the loss of Rashad Penny, who went out of the game. And they've been going particularly to the ground game recently. Of course, last season they were prolific on the ground and they've had a more balanced time of it this time around. But in recent weeks, Penny and Carson have been making hay. It's been billed as a significant ACL sprain, So that means he's not going to be back at any time in the immediate short term. Whether he's done for the season or not, we'll have to see. Let's work out what this means then for the playoff picture, because the Rams now improved to 8-5 with that win. And as we established, chasing a wild card, which at the moment is in the hands of the Minnesota Vikings, because they're behind the Packers in the North, 9-4, assuming, of course, the other wild card is coming from whoever doesn't win the West, whichever the 49ers, the Seahawks doesn't win the West. So realistically, looking at the rest of the teams in the mix, the Bears, despite winning on Thursday Night Football, are now way behind the eight ball, and they're the next best with 7-6, and everybody else has a losing record. So it's going to come down, you would think, to whoever doesn't win the North out of the Vikings and the Packers and the Rams for the final wildcard spot.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Rams running is not awful. But it's also not good. I mean, I suppose it's all a question of perspective. I mean, Cowboys they look pretty bad to me at the moment. So I feel like that's a winnable game for Los Angeles. It is the 49ers after that, which, as we've just been talking about, not an easy game. And then the Cardinals, I mean, the thing which I think is sort of relevant in this Seattle game, which is relevant to that Cardinals game, so, because of course they just blew out the Cardinals, and so you think it's straightforward. But I think it is always relevant when a game is a divisional game. And I think that matters in how well in this game the Rams handled Seattle on defense. And I think it matters in terms of just providing a higher level of variance to all of those games. And I think that includes even the Cardinals game. And the Cardinals have been quite a team I would say with quite a high variance anyway, when you think of how close they played San Francisco and you know, a couple of the games they've won, but also how bad they've been sometimes. So I think it's not an easy path for LA, but it's also not a path you look at and think that's at all impossible. Meanwhile, the Vikings have got the Chargers, Packers, and Bears. And maybe you'd say the same thing, frankly. Some games, there were some pretty high variance. So, and very interesting last few weeks, nothing else.
The Vikings had a pretty straightforward time of it. The Packers, less so, despite being double-digit favorites to beat the Redskins. They started particularly strongly, and we thought, here we go, this is going to be, you know, a 20-point plus victory. But the Redskins battled and certainly made it tighter than I think the Packers would have liked. Who's your money on in that race? Do you think the Vikings can catch Green Bay?
I mean, there's so much on that head-to-head, isn't there? So
that's again, the Christmas Eve game, yeah. In Minnesota as well.
Yeah, I mean, again, definitely can. I might say that I do favor them. I don't know why. I'm having a really hard time trusting the Packers at the moment. I think that's partly to do with some of the eggs they've laid, which just make me sort of feel like there's something brittle about them in a way. I almost think their ceiling is higher than Minnesota's, but I think their floor is worryingly low. And as you said, not a great performance really against a Washington team with 3 wins all season, even if Washington have got some, you know, some good young players there.
NFL.com reporting, one of the things Rogers said off the back of the game was, we don't mind if we're winning ugly. But in the same article, talking about the last 5 games, this is Jeremy Bergman reporting this, saying the last 5 games, the Packers are 3-2 and they've enjoyed a negative 13-point differential. So they are not, unlike the Tennessee Titans, who, as you said, we're going to come on to a little bit later on, very much the form team of the NFL right now. They are not peaking at the right time. Although I guess Packers fans would argue this is perfect timing, as long as we make the playoffs and preferably win the division and then re-up again in January. But at the moment, not winning particularly fluently. Let's move to the AFC, Nikki, and talk, of course, first things first, about the big game at Foxborough, Kansas City getting the win, but the New England Patriots understandably pretty aggrieved about that victory. 23-16 was the final, but the Patriots think they had, and quite understandably feel fairly strong conviction, they had 2 touchdowns taken away from them. You had the Travis Kelce fumble that was picked up, Stephon Gilmore returning it to the house, but the refs had already blown, so he was essentially down by contact there. And then, of course, the N'Keal Harry touchdown that they ruled the rookie receiver was out of bounds when he quite clearly wasn't, but Belichick couldn't challenge it because he'd already thrown both challenges down earlier on in the game. So nothing could be done. And those 2 scores, we'd be having a very different conversation right now.
Yeah, of course. And of course, lots of people aren't feeling too sympathetic to the Patriots because it's no. the Patriots. I mean, I think we should be very clear that two wrongs don't make a right. But of course, it was easy to understand. I put it that way. We are based in the UK and we probably have that slightly, skewed, an audience slightly skewed more towards the Jaguars in some other places. And it was definitely present on my timeline more than my social media timeline, more than one person, just reminding New England gently about a strip sack by Miles Jack in the AFC Championship game that could have changed a lot, shall we say, if the whistle hadn't gone early and stopped him from picking that up and taking it back for a touchdown. So, but
karma. But did you see as well the before any of that happened, the Chiefs' luggage? Do you see that story? The Chiefs' luggage had took quite a long time to get to Foxborough. It ended up in Jersey, apparently. Like 2/3 of the players were without their kit until the 11th hour. So conspiracy theories are abounding. Only New England that would happen, of course. So what do you make, firstly, of the Enkeel Harry touchdown is a bit more clear cut. It was just a bad call. He was in bounds. It shouldn't have been called foot in bounds and out of bounds rather. And sometimes officials make mistakes. Do you think, though, covering both footballs as you do, that there should be a review of any time the ball breaks the plane and there is you would define it. So we got at the moment a review of any scoring play, but should there be a review of anything that looks like a scoring play is what I'm saying. In other words, it's there would be in football.
So there was a lot of chaos in this game. I mean, honestly, I think, the officiating was just bad, in this game and I think that clearly New England had the worst of it because they had bigger, higher profile moments that went against them. But actually even Kansas City had some bad calls against them. It was just a very, disappointing standard of officiating all through the game. In terms of the sideline decision, it's very much the same sort of broad picture for me as the fumble. In both situations, the issue is all about whistles being blown. If a whistle gets blown too early, then you can't presume what would have happened next, because as soon as a whistle is blown and players react differently, then they're not acting as they would otherwise. Which is why we had this sort of big conversation about it after the Miles Jack fumble recovery and non-return against the Patriots, and it's why it's relevant again here. It's why to talk about both footballs. And I have to say, I see some fans in soccer who are very frustrated with the way things are officiated now, with linesmen not raising their flags for offsides until they're certain, because it means that you get far more goals celebrated that then get taken off rather than the other way around. I don't think that part of it matters as much within the context of the NFL, because I think there is much more an understanding and culture of how the replay is used and what it means, and that there will be times when things happen and come back. In fact, that's probably even more ingrained in the game just because of how penalties often work, with flags being assessed after the play. I mean, you know, even before we had replay, we had long touchdown runs coming back for a holding call. We had those sorts of situations.
So Jerome Bogo, who was the ref for the game, was asked about it afterwards. And one of the reporters suggested, why didn't the officials, because it was on the 3-yard line, he was ruled out of bounds. Why didn't the officials think about ruling it a touchdown, knowing that it could be reviewed, right? And doing it that way around, as opposed to giving no call, calling it a touchdown, knowing that it would be reviewed. So if he had gone out of bounds, then that's what would have come out in the wash, which makes a lot of sense. And it's easy, I guess, with 2020 hindsight to say that that's a shrewd maneuver I don't care how experienced an official you are. It wouldn't necessarily cross your mind at the moment, but it made a lot of sense. But he brushed that off and said the two officials were covering it. They looked at it in real time. The guy that would have ruled a touchdown had him short. Maybe if the official on the goal line had a touchdown, could have looked at it that way. But it essentially saying that the official whose job it was to assess whether he was out of bounds had already ruled him out of bounds, right? So it kind of sidestepped it, but difficult once again to, you know, putting the officials in the front line in such a significant game, such a significant moment. And the fact that there were two bad calls in the game that basically cost the Patriots, it was a bad day at the office for his crew. There's no doubt about that. Outside of that, outside of the officiating challenges, what did you make of the game? Because the Patriots started incredibly brightly, but once again, we saw much of what we've seen for this season. Defensively standing reasonably firm, offensively just not in sync at all.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, by the way, with the officiating decisions, not wanting to minimize, because of course you want these things to be right, but it's not a playoff game. The Patriots already were out of position for the number one seed and still are in very good position for the number two seed. So actually how much it's going to impact them, I'm not certain in the grand scheme of things, because they still need to step up again to give the Chiefs a chance of getting beyond them in the AFC. I think that,
and I suppose with the Raiders losing as well, that's a fair point. If you flip it back and the Chiefs win as opposed to loss, and what that means for the AFC West, if the Raiders had won, then John Gruden would understandably be quite aggrieved with what went down as well. But yeah, that's a reasonable point. It's not going to probably change what's going on in the West.
Yeah, unless the Patriots, I mean, if the Patriots continue to lose, but if the Patriots continue to lose, I think they're going to start to have much bigger problems than officiating. Mm. You know, we're in this sort of, I feel like sometimes we're stuck in this sort of loop with the Patriots where year on year you do see slight decline from Tom Brady, and it's, you know, and it's real. But you also don't want to say it, because you're fully aware that even last year when they weren't playing very well for a stretch in the fall, they're capable of turning it on and winning playoff games and winning the Super Bowl, which I think they very much are still at this point. Yep. But I do think it's impossible to frame the way they're playing at the moment without looking at the fact that Tom Brady's got 4.7 yards per attempt in this game, which, look, the Chiefs did a good job on defense, and I think clearly the appointment of Steve Spagnuolo was a good one. Mm. But you know, that's the third time this season that Brady has had 4.7 yards or fewer per attempt. And he'd gone below that mark. It was taken from, I think it's from The Ringer, actually, an article there. Brady had gone below that mark once since 2009, and he's done it three times this season. And it's meaningful. This is, you know, this is a meaningful thing, and we can mythologize and, you know, say that just because he's been the greatest ever that he can't ever decline, or we can acknowledge that he's a man in his 40s and
sure,
and your body is going to have some say in this process at some point.
Let's look at the supporting cast. Obviously has a lot to do with this, right?
Yes, just
look at the stats,
and that's also that
this game, right? So on the ground, and a lot has been made of the absence of James Devlin, their fullback, and the negative impact that's had on establishing the ground game. This is a Kansas City defense that many teams can run on, right? That's mm-hmm. the book on this incarnation of the Andy Reid Chiefs, is they are fallible in certain areas. And in particular, their run D is weak. You can run on them. James White, leading rusher, 6 carries, 33 yards. Second leading rusher, Tom Brady. okay. And then you look at the receiving, right? Edelman, and this seems to be the extent of their offense at the moment. Edelman making some kind of play, 8 catches, 95 yards, and he was overwhelmingly the dynamic playmaker on the offense once again. And then listen to this, Nikki. Jacoby Myers, 1 catch. Okay, albeit 35 yards. That was the trick play from James White, of course. James White himself, 5 catches, 27. So out of the backfield. Matt Lacoste had a couple of catches. Mo Sanu had 1 catch. And Keel Harry had 1 catch. Sony Michel, 1 catch for 1 yard. Rex Burkhead, Philip Dorsett, didn't have any catches. So it is slim pickings when you have Edelman and then next to nothing else going on.
Yeah, completely. I think that's a very valid point, and probably more important than me honing on Tom Brady. But I mean, obviously Rob Gronkowski being gone has already been transformative loss to the offense, and of course it would be, because he is possibly the most impactful tight end of all time. Sort of absence even since the start of the season. You think how much better the offense looked at the start of the season. You think that it feels like a different year, doesn't it? It feels like a different lifetime ago that there was Antonio Brown and Josh Gordon as part of this offense. I mean, there's been a lot taken away from this offense since the start of the year. And you know, you're dead right. James White is a very good pass catching back. But if that's basically the only other weapon in your offense, beyond Julian Edelman, who again is a great wide receiver, but he's a very specific kind of receiver. He's you know, he's undersized. He's someone who's going to do his best work, catching his, you know, well-run routes over the middle. You haven't got an option to take the top off a defense. You haven't got a steady, option to grind it out in the running game. Tom Brady, I was trying to think where I saw it earlier this week, someone, making reference to the fact that, some of the various, backup quarterbacks he's worked with in New England have commented on how he's always, he always challenges his backups to foot races and is adamant that he's faster than most people think he is. As you say, when he's your, you know, when he's a focal point of your running game, something's not
something's
going
wrong. Some stats to pull out or some other key points from this game, and we'll move on. Talk about Baltimore. Patriots now 0-3 this season against the other divisional leaders in the AFC. The games they've lost, Baltimore, Houston, and Kansas City. At 61 points New England allowed in the first 8 games of the season, 107 in their last 5, and that's where those 3 losses have come. So if we're talking about timing and momentum and all those buzzwords that get thrown around in December as we head towards the playoffs, New England are certainly on the wrong side of that. Although, as you rightly say, let's be incredibly mindful of 2 things. They've done this so many times before, last season being an operative example there, and there is the potential in this offense. We've been saying a lot over the last few weeks that there's some of the names I threw out there, all it takes is 2 of them to start stepping into gear, and for McDaniels and Brady to find out a way to start using them more effectively. And then we're talking about an entirely different offense, because Sanu is a great, he's a very good receiver. Yeah. And Keel Harry has the potential to be a very good receiver. So it's not, all is not lost as far as New England are concerned.
Well, no, absolutely. And also, you know, keep in mind on top of those things that their remaining 3 games in the regular season include Cincinnati and Miami. So really the only one that should be any sort of threat to them at all should be the Bills. Now that's an interesting game, because the Bills have, you know, shown up in this second part of the season beyond where I thought they were going to be. But it's not exactly a daunting run in from here to the playoffs either.
Let's talk about the Bills. Disappointing offensively against Baltimore yesterday. Defensively, they really held firm, and the Ravens are throwing a lot at them. And a couple of times in the red zone, they held their nerve, but they couldn't hold on because the offense was not at the races at all. And this has been, and this is hardly a particularly hot take, Nikki, and certainly not, you know, anything I think all of our listeners would have worked out as well. But you look, just take a deep breath and look at this Bills offense in terms of talent, and it is pretty threadbare across the board. And with Josh Allen being still a bit of an enigma, no doubt about his ability on the ground, and he has looked the part, he looked decent against Dallas in Thanksgiving, but he's not the finished article, quite obviously, and just doesn't have enough around him. So for this team, well, the tenor of this team succeeding has been defensively bossing games and then grinding out the win. And this was a good example of how that formula up against an elite side falls down. So while the defense was, as I say, holding on and toughing it out and keeping them in the game, the offense couldn't do anything. Allen completed less than 50% of his passes, averaging 3.7 yards per attempt, 62.4 quarterback rating. So Baltimore's defense holding firm. And Lamar Jackson wasn't exactly a virtuoso performance from him. That's the trouble now. And I think you and I have talked before about the problem of a player like Lamar Jackson. It's a bit like Messi or Ronaldo, that if they're not doing something world-beating every single time they're on the ball, then they're not having a great game. And Lamar Jackson did what he needed to do and got the win. Incidentally, passing Michael Vick, Michael Vick, the only quarterback to rush for 1,000 yards in a season. He's 23 to break the record. Vick's record set back in 2006 was 1,039 yards on the ground. So Lamar Jackson is going to beat that record this season. What did you make of the game and the Ravens' performance?
Well, I'm just going to say this to begin. I know everyone hates hearing about everyone else's fantasy teams, but I thought people might enjoy this because it involves suffering. I subbed out the Bills defense in a fantasy playoff game yesterday because I thought it's Lamar Jackson. It's the, you know, it's this Baltimore offense. Don't want to go up against that. Threw in the Carolina Panthers off waivers a potential 5 points to minus eight and lost by 10 points.
So, oh no. You
know, yeah. Well, I need, I almost could have done better by just not, but I would have done better. Almost
not starting a defense.
Just by not starting a defense. So there you go. I mean, I think, I don't know. To me, this was an encouraging game for the Bills. And, you know, that's all about my perception of them rather than necessarily, you know, encouraging from the point of view that I think that it means they can win something this year, because I ultimately don't. The issue is just that fits under the narrative of things we can go around the houses on, but Josh Allen is not a high caliber NFL quarterback. He's just not. And, on top of which, since we've given Tom Brady this, acknowledgement, I think we can acknowledge that he hasn't really got that many NFL caliber, high caliber, weapons around him.
Yeah.
Cole Beasley is a limited slot receiver, and he's, you know, basically the number two in that offense, but, you know, with John Brown being a deep threat. And even John Brown, I like him, but he's not one of the NFL's elite deep threats. You know, he's got some ability to create separation, but he's not a particularly special player. So then he's not surrounded by brilliant weapons, Josh Allen, but he's not a player who's going to have a transformatively positive effect on your offense. You're hoping that he can manage things and just not create harm in some situations. And to an extent, that is what he did here. I mean, he didn't throw any interceptions. I suppose he did lose a fumble. As you say, the yards per attempt were very, very low. He didn't do as much as he does with his legs in some games. But I just think it's a very easy offense for a good team to prepare for. It's not a thing that's going to surprise you. It's not an offense that has enough tools to do anything particularly different to what it does. So they are relying on their defense. And to that extent, I think you can be encouraged, because I thought, and hence why they weren't in my fantasy team, I thought that the Ravens were going to have their way against this Bills team, because I thought they would have so many chances. I thought that just by simple consequence of how many times, with the Bills offense being as bad as it is, how many times the Ravens were going to have the ball in Lamar Jackson's hands, that this would be a blowout. And it wasn't actually. I mean, I don't think it ever really felt like a game that the Bills could win, but it wasn't a blowout either. So I don't know. I think that's probably as good as I thought this game could go for Buffalo.
So the Bills blowing their chance to take the number one overall seed, of course, because with that Patriots defeat, that's exactly what they could have done. But the Ravens, with the win, have possession of that at the moment with 11-2, their record. The Patriots stay with a first round bye and probably lock down the AFC East, you would think, given the run-in that Nikki was referencing. The Chiefs are the third seed, the Texans the fourth seed, the Bills and the Steelers the two wild cards. And it's the Texans and the AFC South that will end up on, because they are now, after their shock defeat this weekend, on the same record as the Titans, who are currently out of the playoff picture, but as we've identified, one of the form teams right now in the league. And you're right, Tannehill, 6-1 and averaging almost 32 points a game since he has stepped in. Is he the comeback player of the year, Ryan Tannehill?
You know what? It's a strong case, isn't it? The only question to the comeback player of the year is, did he ever arrive in the first place?
That is harsh.
I mean,
the man's a playoff quarterback.
That's true. But I mean, it's astonishing, isn't it? Like, it's sort of gone beyond the sort of funny thing where you're like, oh, look at Ryan Tannehill having a couple of good games. You sort of look around and go, this is still happening. I mean, he's playing.
Yeah.
Really sort of lights out high level football now for like half a season, and playing to a level that statistically is well beyond anything that he achieved during any of his sort of previous, 6 years was it as a starter in Miami?
With the playoff season notwithstanding, but you're right, actually he's playing beyond that.
I think statistically he's way ahead of even in the playoff season. Like his numbers this season are incredible. And you watch it and some of the things he's doing are absurd. I mean, the sort of spinning throwback across his body for Jonnu Smith in the end zone. It's not a percentage play, really. It's not probably a very smart play to make that sometimes, unless you sort of have really next level arm strength. It's a very hard throw to sort of deliver accurately and fast enough to beat a defense. But it's like everything he does is coming off. And again, you know, when it was two or three games, you sort of just laughed at it and thought, oh, it's just something weird and quirky that's happening. But we're now 7 games in, are we, to this sort of extra chapter of Ryan Tannehill. In the meantime, Tennessee, who didn't look like a playoff team, have gone to looking like a team that very probably are going to make the playoffs.
And given the week we've just seen as well, the weekend of football we've just seen, and all the extraordinary plays, not least in the Saints 49ers game, the fact that he has, without a shadow of a doubt, the play of the weekend with his tackle.
Oh my God, how did I not mention that? That's what I was thinking of all day. Yes,
the play of possibly the season. I mean, it was brilliant. So if you haven't seen it, so he threw a pick. Who was running it back? It was a big unit. I can't remember who.
It was Maurice Hurst.
Okay. Who is difficult person to stop at the best of times.
Oh, yes. Probably like 300 pounds.
300 pounds was motoring. He was in fifth gear for him. And Tannehill didn't just throw, which you often see it, that kind of quarterback or on your shoulder in type block and try. And, I mean, it was a perfectly executed, flawless tackle.
Yeah, I'm thinking to myself how different things could have been if the Saints had just had Tannehill on defense to deal with George Kittle.
Take care of Kittle. Now, I don't want to keep making glib or easy comparisons with football, with European football, just for the sake of it, because you are on and know so much about both disciplines. But a player that springs to mind here, and if I'm going off on a tangent, just shut me up, but a player that springs to mind and thinking about why Tannehill, 7-8 years into his career, it's suddenly clicking. This does happen sometimes in sport, that look, he was a first round draft pick. He clearly showed potential for periods of time. So he wasn't one of those players that we thought of as a bust per se. It didn't really work out in the end. And he probably did underperform, but he wasn't a complete blowout, unlike, I don't know, say a Jake Locker, right? Or, you know, I don't know, Jake Locker, that's a bit harsh, but you know, any number of first round quarterbacks that have been taken between, you know, sort of 3 and 25, 32 level pick that have just done nothing.
He's a much better quarterback than, say, Brock Osweiler.
Brock Osweiler, there we go.
Who even Brock Osweiler had the odd game here or there, but he never had a run like this, nor indeed the playoff run that as you were referencing, that Tannehill had in Miami.
So the player that springs to mind is Dmitri Payet. Now, hear me out for a minute. That season,
I feel like the player that springs to mind is always going to be a West Ham player.
Well, fair enough. It's a narrow reference point. It's Stuart Slater. No, it's Dmitri Payet. Payet, of course, had that defining season a few years back at, what was he, 28, 29 years old, roughly. He was a player that we knew was talented, was certainly not somebody you would dismiss with a scoff, and, you know, was a player with ability, but suddenly something changed, and it's rare to see it, I guess, at that stage, that age of a player's career and development. And a lot of it was about situation, which is something we talk about all the time in sports, and particularly in the NFL. Tannehill, it might just be, this has always been inside him, but he just needed the right stars to align. And it is really interesting to see how far this will go, because the difference between, say, a backup quarterback coming in and having a bit of a run and then reverting to the norm, it explains why they're a backup, because they can't retain that level of performance to that for that sustained a period, and in particular defenses are working them out and making it harder for that quarterback to play against them, and it levels itself out. In this situation, we know Tannehill can be a starter for a sustained period of time. We know he can keep a pretty decent level for a sustained period of time. So I wonder how long he can play at this exceptional level. And I feel a little bit remiss, Nicky, because I was referring to him in my column and on air, I think, last night, as, you know, a level above a game manager, but certainly not a player that can win you a game. I think I've got that wrong. I think he is showing that he is a player that can win you a game.
Oh, I mean, he is winning them games right now. Whether or not it's sustainable, whether or not it's something that will last, whether or not we are just in some sort of beautiful window of Tannehill mania. You know, that's a harder question to answer. And I know that Tennessee are slightly in a quandary on that, of course, the team now, because, you know, they are starting to look seriously at new contracts and lining up, next season as a plan in which Tannehill will be the number one guy going in. And it would be sort of it would be crazy not to be thinking about that almost the way he's playing at the moment. And of course, with that is the sort of nagging thought, what if this is just a bubble and it's going to burst? But as of today, as of the way he's, you know, been for the last 6-7 weeks, I think he's playing at a higher level than lots of other starting quarterbacks in the NFL. He just is.
Yeah, on that point, Tannehill and Derrick Henry, neither under contract at the moment for 2020. So things get very interesting for Tennessee. Cracking stuff, Nikki. That we could have quite conceivably talked for about another hour on the stuff that went down. But we are out of time for the pod today. But no doubt about it, next time you're on, I know it's a guaranteed stone cold spot. It's going to be a storming weekend of football to talk about.
Of course, of course.
Brilliant stuff. Look after yourself. We'll see you soon.
See you soon. Bye.
Fine stuff from Nikki. I'm back with Iron Mike on Wednesday. Jay Bell is in the house on Friday. I think I might have trailed him as in the house last Friday, but of course, that was wrong. He's in this Friday. That is an absolute promise. And our Paddy Power Fantasy League is back, incidentally. So get involved with that. PaddyPowerFantasy.com. If you check the links on our social media channels at the NC Show, that's how you'll find it and get involved. It's free to enter. Lots of cash prizes. Loads of you have been playing for a lot of the season and enjoying it. And winning dollar as well. So what is not to love about that? And one more thing for the road. If you haven't already, whichever podcatcher you listen to us on and you're able to, go and drop a nice review. Just give us a nice review. Hey, it's coming towards Christmas. Both Harry and Ollie are producers. It'll put a big fat smile on their faces for sure. And it helps us with all kinds of things. So if you're liking and enjoying the show, you're getting 4 times a week. We would massively appreciate that. Right, back on Wednesday with Iron Mike. Look forward to it. See you then. Bye for now.